This is Audible.
Penguin Audio presents 1 Plus 1, written by Jojo Moyes, read by Elizabeth Bauer, Ben Elliott, Nicholas Stanton, and Stephen France.
Prologue. Ed. Ed Nichols was in the creatives room drinking coffee with Ronan when Sydney walked in. A man he vaguely recognized stood behind him, another of the suits. "We've been looking for you," Sydney said. "Well, you found us," Ed said. "Not Ronan, you." Ed studied them for a minute. Then he threw a red foam ball at the ceiling and caught it. He glanced sideways at Ronan. InvestorCorp had bought half shares in the company a full 18 months ago, but Ed and Ronan still thought of them as the suits. It was one of the kinder things they called them in private. "Do you know a woman called Deanna Lewis?" "Why?" "Did you give her any information about the launch of the new software?" "What?" "It's a simple question." Ed looked from one suit to the other. The atmosphere was strangely charged. His stomach, a packed elevator, began a slow descent toward his feet. "We may have chatted about work. No specifics that I remember."
"Deanna Lewis," said Ronan.
"You need to be clear about this, Ed. Did you give her any information about the launch of S-Fax?" "No." "Maybe. What is this?" "The police are downstairs searching your office with two goons from the Financial Services Authority. Her brother has been arrested for insider trading, on the basis of information that you gave them about the launch of the software."
"Deanna Lewis. Our Deanna Lewis."
Ronan began to wipe his spectacles, a thing he did when he was feeling anxious. "Her brother's hedge fund made $2.6 million on the first day of trading. She alone cleared $190,000 on her personal account."
"Her brother's hedge fund?"
"I don't understand," Ronan said. "I'll spell it out. Deanna Lewis is on record talking to her brother about the launch of S-Fax. She says Ed here said it was going to be enormous. And guess what? 2 days later, her brother's fund is among the biggest purchasers of shares. What exactly did you tell her?" Ronan stared at him. Ed struggled to gather his thoughts. When he swallowed, it was shamefully audible. Across the office, the development team was peering over the tops of their cubicles. "I didn't tell her anything," he blinked. "I don't know. I might have said something. It's not like it was a state secret." "It was a fucking state secret, Ed," Sydney said. "It's called insider trading. She told him you gave her dates, times. You told her the company was going to make a fortune."
"Then she's lying, shooting her mouth off. We were just having a thing."
"You wanted to bone the girl, so you shot your mouth off to impress her."
"It wasn't like that."
"You had sex with Deanna Lewis."
Ed could feel Ronan's myopic gaze burning into him. Sydney lifted his hands. "You need to call your lawyer."
"How can I be in trouble?" Ed asked. "It's not like I got any benefit from it. I didn't even know her brother had a hedge fund."
Sydney glanced behind him. The faces suddenly found something interesting to look at on their desks. He lowered his voice. "You have to go now. They want to interview you at the police station."
"What? This is nuts. I've got a software meeting in 20 minutes. I'm not going to any police station."
"And obviously we're suspending you until we've got to the bottom of this." Ed half laughed.
"Are you kidding me? You can't suspend me. It's my company."
He threw the foam ball up in the air and caught it, turning away from them. Nobody moved.
"I'm not going. This is our company. Tell them, Ronan."
He looked at Ronan, but Ronan was staring fixedly at something on the floor. Ed looked at Sydney, who shook his head. Then he looked up at the two uniformed men who had appeared behind him, at his secretary, whose hand was covering her mouth, at the carpet path already opening up between him and the door, and the foam ball dropped silently onto the floor between his feet.
Chapter 1. Jess.
Jess Thomas and Natalie Benson slumped in the seats of their van, which was parked far enough away from Natalie's house that they couldn't be seen from the inside. Natalie was smoking. She had given it up for the fourth time 6 weeks ago.
£80 a week guaranteed and holiday pay, Natalie let out a scream. Bloody hell! I actually want to find the tart who left that earring and thump her for losing us our best job.
Maybe she didn't know he was married.
Oh, she knew.
Before she'd met Dean, Natalie had spent 2 years with a man who turned out to have not one, but two families on the other side of Southampton.
No single man keeps colour-coordinated scatter cushions on his bed.
Neil Brewster does, Jess said.
Neil Brewster's music collection is 67% Judy Garland, 33% Pet Shop Boys.
They had cleaned together every weekday for 4 years, since back when the beachfront holiday park was part paradise, part building site. Back when the developers promised local families access to the swimming pool and assured everyone that a large upmarket development would bring benefits to their little seaside town, instead of sucking out what remained of its life. The faded moniker, Benson and Thomas Cleaning, was stenciled on the side of their white van. Natalie had added underneath,
"A bit dirty. Can we help?"
Until Jess pointed out that for 2 whole months, half the calls they had received had been nothing to do with cleaning. Nearly all their jobs were in the beachfront development now. Hardly anybody in town had the money or the inclination to hire a cleaner, except for the doctors, the solicitor, and the odd client like Mrs. Humphrey, whose arthritis had stopped her from doing it herself. It was a good job on the one hand. You could work for yourself, organise your own hours, pick and choose your clients for the most part. The downside, weirdly, was not the crappy clients, and there always was at least one crappy client. Or that scrubbing someone else's toilet somehow left you feeling like you were one step lower on a ladder than you had planned to be. Jess didn't mind pulling lumps of hair out of other people's plug holes, or the fact that most people who rented holiday homes seemed to feel obliged to live like pigs for a week. What she didn't like was that you ended up finding out much more about other people's lives than you really wanted to. Jess could have told you about Mrs. Eldridge's secret shopping habit, the designer shoe receipt she stuffed into the bathroom bin, and the bags of unworn clothes in her wardrobe, the tags still firmly attached. She could tell you that Lena Thompson had been trying for a baby for 4 years and used 2 pregnancy tests a month. Rumour had it, she left her tights on. She could tell you that Mr. Mitchell, in the big house behind the church, earned a 6-figure salary. He left his payslips on the hall table. Natalie swore he did it deliberately. And that his daughter smoked secretly in the bathroom and lined up all her cigarette butts in neat rows on the window ledge. If she was that way inclined, she could have pointed out the women who went out looking immaculate, hair faultless, nails polished, lightly spritzed with expensive scent, who thought nothing of leaving soiled knickers in full view on the floor. Or the teenage boys whose stiff towels she didn't want to pick up without a pair of tongs. There were the couples who spent every night in separate beds, the wives insisting brightly when they asked her to change the spare room sheets that they'd had an awful lot of guests lately, the lavatories that required a gas mask and a Hazchem warning. And then, every now and then, you got a nice client like Lisa Ritter and popped over to vacuum her floors and came home with a whole load of knowledge you could really have done without. "It's probably my daughter's. From when she came home last time, she's got a pair just like it."
"Of course," Jess said. "It probably got kicked in here or carried in on someone's shoe. We knew it would be something like that."
And she knew, right then, when Mrs. Ritter turned away from her, that that would be it. Nobody thanked you for bringing bad news to their door. At the end of the road, a padded toddler toppled gently onto the ground like a felled tree, and after a brief silence, let out a thin wail. Its mother, her 2 armloads of shopping bags perfectly balanced, stood and stared in mute dismay.
"Look, you heard what she said the other week. She'd get rid of her hairdresser before she'd get rid of us. Before she got rid of the cleaners. That's different. She won't care whether it's us or Speedy Cleans or maids with mops."
Natalie shook her head. "Nope. To her, from now on, we'll always be the cleaners who know the truth about her husband. It matters to women like her. They're all about appearances, aren't they?" The mother put
put down her bags and stooped to pick up the toddler. Jess put her bare feet up on the dashboard and let her face fall into her hands. Bugger it. How are we going to make up for money, Nat? That was our best job. The house was immaculate. It was basically a twice-a-week polishing job. Natalie stared out of the window. And she always paid on time. Jess kept seeing that diamond earring. Why hadn't they just ignored it? It would have been better if one of them had stolen it. Okay, so she's going to cancel us. Let's change the subject, Nat. I can't afford to cry before my pub shift. So, did Marty ring this week? I didn't mean change the subject to that. Well, did he? Jess sighed. Yep. Did he say why he didn't ring the week before? Natalie shoved Jess's feet off the dashboard. Nope. Jess could feel her staring. And no, he didn't send any money. Oh, come on! You've got to get the Child Support Agency onto him. You can't carry on like this. He should send money for his own kids. It was an old argument. He's still not right, Jess said. I can't put more pressure on him. He hasn't got a job yet. Well, you're going to need that money now, until we get another job like Lisa Ritter's. How's Nicky? Oh, I went round to Jason Fisher's house to talk to his mum. Oh, you're joking! She scares the pants off me! Did she say she'd get him to leave Nicky alone? Something like that. Natalie kept her eyes on Jess and dropped her chin 2 inches. She told me if I set foot on her doorstep once more, she'd batter me halfway to next Wednesday. Me and my... what was it? Me and my freakazoid kids. Jess pulled down the passenger mirror and checked her hair, pulling it back into a ponytail. Oh, and then she told me her Jason wouldn't hurt a fly. Typical. He's fine. I had Norman with me. And bless him, he took an enormous dump next to their Toyota, and somehow I forgot I had a plastic bag in my pocket. Jess put her feet back up. Natalie pushed them down again and mopped the dashboard with a wet wipe. Seriously, though, Jess, how long has Marty been gone? 2 years? You've got to get back on the horse. You're young. You can't wait around for him to sort himself out, she said with a grimace. Get back on the horse. Nice. Liam Stubbs fancies you. You could totally ride that. Any certified pair of X chromosomes could ride Liam Stubbs. Jess closed the window. I'm better off reading a book. Besides, I think the kids have had enough upheaval in their lives without playing meet your new uncle. Right. She looked up, wrinkled her nose at the sky. I've got to get the tea on and then I've got to get ready for the pub. I'll do a quick ring round before I go, see if any of the clients want any extras doing, and you never know, she might not cancel us. Natalie lowered her window and blew out a long trail of smoke. Sure, Dorothy, and our next job is going to be cleaning the Emerald City at the end of the Yellow Brick Road. Number 14, Sea Cove Avenue, was filled with the sound of distant explosions. Tansy had calculated recently that since he'd turned 16, Nicky had spent 88% of his spare time in his bedroom. Jess could hardly blame him. She dropped her cleaning crate in the hall, hung up her jacket, made her way upstairs, feeling the familiar faint dismay at the threadbare state of the carpet, and pushed at his door. He was wearing a set of headphones and shooting somebody. The smell of weed was strong enough to make her reel. Nicky, she said, and someone exploded in a hail of bullets. Nicky! She walked over to him and pulled his headphones off so that he turned, his expression briefly bemused like someone hauled from sleep. Hard at work, then. Study break. She picked up an ashtray and held it toward him. I thought I told you. Well, it's from last night. I couldn't sleep. Not in the house, Nicky. There was no point telling him not at all. They all did it round here. She told herself she was lucky he'd only started at 15. Is Tansy back yet? She stooped to pick up stray socks and mugs from the floor. No. Oh, the school rang after lunch. What? He typed something into the computer, then turned to face her. I don't know. Something about school? It was then that she saw it.
She lifted a lock of that dyed black hair, and there it was. A fresh mark on his cheekbone. He ducked away. Are you okay? He shrugged, looked away from her. Did they come after you again? I'm fine. Why didn't you call me? No credit on my phone. He leant back and fired a virtual grenade. The screen exploded into a ball of flame. He replaced his earphones and went back to the screen. Nicky had come to live with Jess full-time 8 years previously. He was Marty's son by Della, a woman he'd gone out with briefly in his teens. He had arrived silent and wary, his limbs thin and elongated, his appetite raging. His mother had fallen in with a new crowd, finally disappearing to somewhere in the Midlands with a man called Big Al, who wouldn't look anyone in the eye and clutched an ever-present can of Tennant's Extra like a hand grenade in his oversized fist. Nicky had been found sleeping in the locker rooms at school, and when the social workers called again, Jess had said he could come to them. "Just what you need," Natalie had said. "Another mouth to feed." "He's my stepson. You've met him twice in 4 years, and you're not even 20. Well, that's how families are these days. Afterwards, she sometimes wondered whether that had been the final straw, the thing that had caused Marty to abdicate responsibility for his family altogether. But Nicky was a good kid. Under all the raven hair and eyeliner, he was sweet to Tansy, and on his good days he talked and laughed and allowed Jess the occasional awkward hug. And she was glad of him, even if it sometimes felt as if she had basically acquired one more person to feel anxious about. She stepped out into the garden with the phone and took a deep breath, her stomach a knot of anxiety. Hello? It's Jessica Thomas here. I had a message to call. A pause. Tansy? Is everything all right? Sorry, I should have said. It's Mr. Tsvangirai here, Tansy's maths teacher. Oh. She pictured him, a tall man in a grey suit, face like a funeral director's. I wanted to talk to you because a few weeks ago, I had a very interesting discussion with a former colleague of mine who works for St. Anne's. St. Anne's? Jess frowned. The private school. Yes, they have a scholarship program for children who are exceptionally gifted in maths. And as you know, we had already earmarked Tansy as gifted and talented. Because she's good at maths. Better than good. Well, we gave her the paper to sit last week. I don't know if she mentioned it. I sent a letter home, but I wasn't sure you saw it. Jess squinted at the sky. Seagulls wheeled and swooped against the grey. A few gardens down, Terry Blackstone had started singing along to a radio. He had been known to do the full Rod Stewart if he thought nobody was looking. We got the results back this morning, and she has done well. Extremely well, Mrs. Thomas. If you're agreeable, they would like to interview her for a subsidised place. She found herself parroting him. A subsidised place? For certain children of exceptional ability, St. Anne's will forego a significant proportion of the school's fees. That means that Tansy will get a top-class education. She has an extraordinary numerical ability, Mrs. Thomas. I do think this could be a great opportunity for her. St. Anne's? But she'd need to get a bus across town. She'd need all the uniform and kit. She wouldn't know anyone. She'd make friends. But these are just details, Mrs. Thomas. Let's wait and see what the school comes up with. Tansy is an extraordinarily talented girl. He paused. When she didn't say anything, he lowered his voice. I have been teaching maths for almost 22 years, Mrs. Thomas, and I have never met a child who grasped mathematical concepts like she does. I believe she is actually exceeding the point where I have anything to teach her. Algorithms, probability, prime numbers. Okay, this is where you lose me, Mr. Tsvangirai. I'll just go with gifted and talented. He chuckled. I'll be in touch. She put down the phone and sat heavily on the white plastic garden chair that had been there when they'd moved in and had now grown a fine sheen of emerald moss. She stared at nothing. In through the window at the curtains that Marty always thought were too bright. At the red plastic tricycle that she had never got round to getting rid of. At next door's cigarette butts sprinkled like confetti on her path. At the rotten boards in the fence that the dog insisted on sticking his head through. Despite what Natalie referred to as her frankly misguided optimism, Jess found her eyes had filled unexpectedly with tears. There were lots of awful things about the father of your children leaving. The money issues, the suppressed anger on behalf of your children, the way most of your coupled-up friends now treated you as if you were some kind of potential husband stealer. But worse than that, worse than the endless, relentless, bloody exhausting financial and energy-sapping struggle, was that being a parent on your own when you were totally out of your depth was actually the loneliest place on earth.
Chapter 2. Tansy. 26 cars sat in the car park at St. Anne's. Two rows of 13 big, shiny four-wheel drives faced each other on each side of a gravel path, sliding in and out of the spaces at an average angle of 41 degrees, before the next in line moved in. Tansy watched them as she and Mum crossed the road from the bus stop, the drivers talking illegally into phones or mouthing at bug-eyed blonde babies in the rear seats. Mum lifted her chin and fiddled with her house keys in her free hand, as if they were actually her car keys, and she and Tansy just happened to have parked somewhere nearby. Mum kept glancing behind her. Tansy guessed she was worried she was going to bump into one of her cleaning clients, who would ask her what she was doing there. She had never been inside St. Anne's, although she'd been past it on the bus at least 10 times, because the NHS dentist was on this road. From the outside, there was just an endless hedge, trimmed to exactly 90 degrees. She wondered if the gardener used a protractor. And those big trees where the branches hung low and friendly, sweeping out across the playing fields as if they were there to shelter the children below. The children at St. Anne's did not swing bags at each other's heads or bundle up in huddles by the corner of the playground, backing someone against the wall to tax their lunch money. There were no weary-sounding teachers trying to herd the teenagers into classrooms. The girls had not rolled their skirts 6 times over at the waistband or backcombed their hair. Not a single person was smoking. A lot of them wore glasses. Her mother gave her hand a little squeeze. Tansy wanted her to stop looking so nervous. "It's nice, isn't it, Mum?" She nodded. "Yes." It came out as a squeak. Mr. Svangerai told me that every single one of their 6th formers who did maths got A or A starred. That's good, isn't it? Amazing. Tansy pulled a bit at Mum's hand so they could get to the headmaster's office faster. Do you think Norman will miss me when I'm doing the long days? The long days? St. Anne's doesn't finish till 6, and there's maths club on Tuesdays and Thursdays. I definitely want to do that. Her mother glanced at her. She looked really tired. She was always tired these days. She put on one of those smiles that wasn't really a smile at all, and they went in. "Hello, Mrs. Thomas. Hello, Costanza. It's very good to meet you. Do sit down." The headmaster's study had a high ceiling, as white and perfectly decorated as a wedding cake. Little white plaster rosettes sat every 20 centimetres, and tiny rosebuds exactly halfway between them. The room was stuffed with old furniture, and through a large bay window, a man on a roller could be seen travelling up and down a cricket pitch. On a small table, somebody had laid out a tray of coffee and handmade biscuits. You could tell they were homemade. Mum used to make biscuits before Dad left, and they were just like these. She sat down on the edge of the sofa and gazed at the 2 men opposite. The one with the moustache smiled like the nurse did before she gave you an injection. Mum had pulled her bag onto her lap, and Tansy could see her holding her hand over the corner where Norman had chewed it. Her leg was jiggling. "This is Mr. Cruikshank. He's the head of maths, and I'm Mr. Daly. I've been head here for the past 2 years. She looked up from her biscuit. Do you do chords?
We do.
And probability?
That too.
Mr. Cruikshank leant forward. We've been looking at your test results, and we think, Costanza, that you should sit your GCSE in maths next year and get it out of the way, because I think you'd rather enjoy the A-level problems. She looked at him. Have you got actual papers?
I've got some next door. Would you like to see them?
She couldn't believe he was asking. She thought briefly of saying, well, duh, like Nicky did, but she just nodded. Mr. Daly handed Mum a coffee.
I won't beat around the bush, Mrs. Thomas. You are well aware that your daughter has an exceptional ability. We have only seen scores like hers once before, and that was from a pupil who went on to be a fellow at Trinity.
He went on and on then. She tuned out a bit because she was trying to see how many biscuits she could eat, so what she heard was, for a very select group of pupils who have a demonstrably unusual ability, we have created a new equal access scholarship. Blah, blah, blah. It would offer a child who might not otherwise get the advantages of a school like this the chance to fulfil their potential in... blah, blah. While we are very keen to see how far Costanza could go in the field of maths, we would also want to make sure that she was well-rounded in other parts of her student life. We have a full sporting and musical curriculum. Blah, blah, blah. Numerate children are often also able in languages. Blah, blah. And drama. That's often very popular with girls of her age.
I only really like maths, she told him. And dogs?
Well, we don't have much in the way of dogs, but we'd certainly offer you lots of opportunities to stretch yourself mathematically. But I think you might be surprised by what else you enjoy.
Do you play any instruments?
She shook her head.
Any languages?
The room went a bit quiet.
Other interests? We go swimming on Fridays, Mum said. We haven't been swimming since Dad left.
Mum smiled, but it went a bit wonky.
We have, Tansy.
Once, May the 13th, but now you work on Fridays. Her smile went really strange then, like she couldn't hold the corners of her mouth up properly. Mr. Cruikshank left the room and reappeared a moment later with his papers. She stuffed the last of the biscuit into her mouth, then got up and went to sit next to him. He had a whole pile of them, stuff she hadn't even started yet. She began going through them with him, showing him what she had done and what she hadn't, and in the background she could hear Mum and the headmaster's voices rumbling away. It sounded like it was going all right. Tansy let her attention travel to what was on the page. It might have been renewal theory.
Yes, Mr. Cruikshank was saying quietly, his finger on the page.
But the curious feature of renewal process is that if we wait some predetermined time and then observe how large the renewal interval containing it is, we should expect it to be typically larger than a renewal interval of average size.
She knew about this.
So the monkeys would take longer to type Macbeth, she said.
That's it, he smiled. I wasn't sure you'd have covered any renewal theory.
I haven't, really, but Mr. Svangerai told me about it once, and I looked it up on the internet. I liked the whole monkey thing.
She flicked through the papers. There was tons of it. The numbers sang to her. She could feel her brain sort of humming. She wanted to read them so much. She knew she had to go to this school.
Mum, she said.
She didn't usually interrupt, but she was too excited and forgot her manners.
Do you think we could get some of these papers?
Mr. Daly looked over. He didn't seem to mind about the missing manners.
Mr. Cruikshank, have we any spares?
You can take these.
He handed them over, just like that. Outside, a bell rang and she could hear children walking past the office window, their shoes crunching on the gravel.
So,
What happens next? Mum asked.
Well, we'd like to offer Tansy, a scholarship. He lifted a glossy folder from the table. Here's our prospectus and the relevant documentation. The scholarship covers 90% of the fees. It's the most generous scholarship this school has ever offered. Usually 50% is our maximum, given the extensive waiting list of pupils hoping to come here. The new scholarship is designed to recognise children with unusual levels of ability. Like me, Tansy said. Like you. He held out the plate towards her. Somehow they had replaced the biscuits on the plate with new ones. This really was the greatest school ever. 90%, Mum said. She put her biscuit back on her saucer. I do appreciate that there is still a considerable financial commitment involved, and there would also be uniform and travel costs and any extras she might want, like music or school trips, but I would like to stress that this is an incredible opportunity. He leant forward. We would love to have you here, Tansy. Your math teacher says you're a joy to work with. I like school, she said, reaching for another biscuit. I know lots of my friends think it's boring, but I prefer school to home. They all laughed awkwardly. Not because of you, Mum, she said, and helped herself to another. But my mum does have to work a lot. Everyone went quiet. We all do these days, said Mr. Cruikshank. Well, it's a lot for you to think about, and I'm sure you have other questions for us, but why don't you finish your coffee while we talk, and then I'll get one of our pupils to show you around the rest of the school. Then you can discuss this between yourselves. Tansy was downstairs in the garden throwing a ball for Norman. She was determined that one day he would fetch it and bring it back. Tansy had read somewhere that repetition increases the probability of an animal learning how to do something by a factor of 4. She wasn't sure Norman could count, though. They had got Norman from the animal shelter when Dad first left and Mum stayed awake for 11 nights in a row, worrying that they would be murdered in their beds once everyone realised he'd gone. Brilliant with kids. A fantastic guard dog, the rescue centre said. Mum kept saying, but he's so big. Even more of a deterrent, they said, with cheery smiles. And did we mention, he's brilliant with kids. 2 years on, Mum said Norman was basically an enormous eating and crapping machine. He plodded around the house, shedding hair and leaving evil smells behind him. He drooled on cushions and howled in his sleep, his great paws paddling the air as if he was swimming. Mum said the rescue centre had been right. Nobody would break into their house for fear Norman would gas them to death. She had given up trying to ban him from Tansy's bedroom. When Tansy woke up in the morning, he was always stretched across three quarters of the bed, hairy legs across her mattress, leaving her shivering under a tiny corner of duvet. Mum used to mutter about hairs and hygiene, but Tansy didn't mind. She and Norman had a special bond. She knew that one day he would show it. They'd got Nicky when she was 2. Tansy went to bed one night, and when she woke, he was in the spare room, and Mum just said he would be staying, and he was her brother. Tansy had once asked him what he thought their shared genetic material was, and he'd said, the weird loser gene? She thought he might have been joking, but she didn't know enough about genetics to check. She was rinsing her hands under the tap outside when she heard them talking. Nicky's window was open, and the voices floated out into the garden. Did you pay that water bill? Nicky said. No, I haven't had a chance to get to the post office. It says it's a final reminder. I know it's a final reminder. Mum was snappy, like she always was when she talked about money. There was a pause. Norman picked up the ball and dropped it near her feet. It lay there, slimy and disgusting. Sorry, Nicky, I just need to get this conversation out of the way. I'll sort it out tomorrow morning, I promise. You want to speak to your dad?
Tansy knew what the answer would be. Nikki never wanted to talk to Dad anymore. Hey! She moved right under the window and stood really still. She could hear Dad's voice. Everything all right? Dad sounded tense. She wondered if he thought that something bad had happened. Perhaps if he thought Tansy had leukemia, he might come back. She had watched a TV film once where the girl's parents divorced and then got back together because she got leukemia. She didn't actually want leukemia, though, because needles made her pass out, and she had quite nice hair. Everything's fine, Mum said. She didn't tell him about Nikki getting battered. What's going on? A pause. Has your mum decorated? Mum asked. What? New wallpaper. Oh, that. Grandma's house had new wallpaper. Tansy felt weird. Dad and Grandma were living in a house that she might not recognise anymore. It had been 348 days since she last saw Dad. It was 433 days since she'd seen Grandma. I need to talk to you about Tansy's schooling. Why? What's she done? Nothing like that, Marty. She's been offered a scholarship to St. Anne's. St. Anne's? They think her maths is off the scale. St. Anne's? He said it like he couldn't believe it. I mean, I knew she was bright, but... He sounded really pleased. She pressed her back against the wall and went up on tippy-toes to hear better. Perhaps he'd come back if she was going to St. Anne's. Our little girl at the posh school, eh? His voice had puffed up with pride. Tansy could imagine him already working out what to tell his mates at the pub. Except he couldn't go to the pub, because he always told Mum he had no money to enjoy himself. So, what's the problem? Well, it's a big scholarship, but it doesn't cover everything. Meaning what? Meaning we'd still have to find £500 a term, and the uniform, and the registration fee of £500. The silence went on for so long Tansy wondered if the computer had crashed. They said once we've been there a year, we can apply for a hardship fee, some bursary or something where, if you're a deserving case, they can give you extra. But basically, we need to find the best part of £2,000 to get her through the first year. And then Dad laughed. He actually laughed. You're having me on, right? No, I am not having you on. How am I meant to find £2,000, Jess? I just thought I've not even got a proper job yet. There's nothing going on round here. I'm only just getting back on my feet. I'm sorry, babe, but there's no way. Can't your mum help? She might have some savings. Can I talk to her? No, she's out, and I don't want you tapping her for money. She's got worries enough as it is. I'm not tapping her for money, Marty. I thought she might want to help her only grandchildren. They're not her only grandchildren anymore. Eleanor had a little boy. Tansy stood very still. I didn't even know she was pregnant. Yeah, I meant to tell you. Tansy had a baby cousin, and she hadn't even known. Norman flopped down at her feet. He looked at her with his big brown eyes, then rolled over slowly with a groan, as if it was really, really hard work just lying on the floor. He kept looking at her, waiting for her to rub his tummy, but she was trying too hard to listen. Well, what if we sell the rolls? I can't sell the rolls! I'm going to start the weddings business up again! It's been rusting in our garage for the best part of 2 years. I know, and I'll come and get it. I just haven't got anywhere to store it safely up here. The voices had that edge now. Their conversations often ended up like that. She heard Mum take a deep breath. Can you at least think about it, Marty? She really wants to go to this place. Really, really wants to go. When the maths teacher spoke to her, her whole face lit up like I haven't seen since... Since I left. I didn't mean it like that. So it's all my fault. No, it's not all your fault, Marty. But I'm not going to sit here and pretend that you going has been a barrel of laughs for them. Tansy doesn't understand why you don't visit her. She doesn't understand why she hardly gets to see you anymore. I can't afford the fares, Jess. You know that. There's no point you going on and on at me. I've been ill. I know you've been ill. She can come and see me any time. I told you. Send them both at half term. I can't. They're too young to travel all that way alone, and I can't afford the fares for all of us. And I suppose that's my fault too. Oh, for Christ's sake! Tansy dug her nails into the soft parts of her hands. Norman kept looking at her, waiting. I don't want to argue with you, Marty, Mum said, and her voice was low and careful, like when a teacher is trying to explain something to you that you should already know. I just want you to think about whether there is any way at all you could contribute to this. It would change Tansy's life. It would mean she never has to struggle in the way that we struggle. You can't say that. What do you mean? Don't you watch the news, Jess? All the graduates are out of work. It doesn't matter what education you get. She's still going to have to fight. She's still going to struggle. He paused. No, there's no point us going further into Hock just for this. Of course these schools are going to tell you it's all special and she's special and her life chances are going to be amazing if she goes, etc., etc. That's what they do. Mum didn't say anything. No, if she's bright like they say she is, she'll make her own way. She'll have to go to MacArthur's like everyone else. Like the little bastards who spend all their time working out how to bash Nicky's face in, and the girls who wear 4 inches of makeup and won't do PE in case they break a nail. She won't fit in there, Marty. She just won't. Now you sound like a snob. No, I sound like someone who accepts that her daughter is a little bit different and might need a school that embraces it. Can't do it, Jess. I'm sorry. He sounded distracted now, as if he'd heard something in the distance. Look, I've got to go. Get her to Skype me Sunday. There was a long silence. Tansy counted to 14. She heard the door open and Nicky's voice. That went well then. She leant over and finally rubbed Norman's tummy. She closed her eyes so she didn't see the tear that plopped onto it. Have we done any lottery tickets lately? No. That silence lasted 9 seconds. Then Mum's voice echoed into the still air. Well, I think maybe we'd better start.
Chapter 3. Ed. Deanna Lewis. Maybe not the prettiest girl, but definitely the one who scored highest on Ed and Ronan's campus-wide girls you'd give one without having to drink a fourth pint first point system. As if she'd look at either of them. He'd bet she'd never once registered him in the whole 3 years, apart from that time when it was raining heavily and she was at the station and asked him for a lift back to Halls in his mini. He had been so tongue-tied the whole time she was in the passenger seat, he had said barely a word, except a vaguely strangled, "No worries," when he let her out at the other end. Those two words somehow managed to cover 3 octaves. She stooped to peel the empty crisps packet from the sole of her boot, dropping it delicately back into the footwell. If Ed had it bad, Ronan had it worse. His love had weighed him down like a cartoon dumbbell. He wrote her poetry, sent anonymous flowers on Valentine's Day, smiled at her in the dinner queue, and tried not to look crushed when she failed to notice. And after they had graduated, set up their company, and swapped thinking about women for thinking about software, until software became the thing they actually preferred thinking about, Deanna Lewis gently morphed into a college reminiscence. Oh, Deanna Lewis, they would say to each other, their eyes distant, like they could see her floating in slow-mo above the other drinkers' heads at the pub. And then, 3 months ago, some 6 months after Lara had left, taking with her the apartment in Rome, half the contents of his stock portfolio, and what remained of Ed's appetite for relationships, Deanna Lewis friended him on Facebook. She had been based in New York for a couple of years, but was coming back, and wanted to catch up with some of her old friends from uni. Did he remember Rena and Sam? Was he around for a drink at all? Afterwards, he was ashamed that he hadn't told Ronan. Ronan was busy with the new software upgrade, he told himself. It had taken him ages to get Deanna out of his system. He was in the early stages of dating that girl from the not-for-profit soup place. Why stir it all up again? The truth was, Ed was still stuck in his post-divorce slough. He hadn't had a date in forever, and a bit of him wanted Deanna Lewis to see what he had become since the company was sold a year previously. Because money, it turned out, bought you someone to sort out your clothes, skin and hair. It bought you a personal trainer. Ed Nichols no longer looked like the tongue-tied geek in the mini. He wore no obvious signs of wealth, but he knew that at 33, he carried it like an invisible scent around him. They met at a bar in Soho. She apologized. Rena, did he remember Rena, had blown them out at the last minute. She had a baby. She lifted a faintly mocking eyebrow as she said this. Sam, he realized long afterwards, never showed. She never once asked about Ronan. He couldn't stop staring at her. She looked just the same, but better. She had well-cut dark hair that bounced on her shoulders like a shampoo advert, and had lost the traces of puppy fat around her cheeks. She was nicer than he remembered, more human. Perhaps even Golden Girls were brought down to earth a little, once out of the confines of university. She laughed at all his jokes. Every now and then he glanced sideways to see her blinking at him, and registered her brief flash of surprise that he was not the person she remembered. It made him feel good. They parted after a couple of hours, and a little piece of him was surprised when she called 2 days later to suggest they hook up again. This time they went to a club and he danced with her, and when she lifted her hands above her head, he had to focus really hard not to picture her pinned to a bed. She was just out of a relationship, she explained, over the third or fourth drink. The breakup had been awful. She was not sure she wanted to be involved in anything serious. He made all the right noises. He told her about Lara, his ex-wife, and how she had said her work was always going to be her first love, and that she had to leave him to save her sanity. "Bit melodramatic," Deanna said. "She's Italian, and an actress. Everything with her is melodramatic." "Was," she corrected him. She kept her eyes on his as she said it. She watched his mouth as he spoke, which was oddly distracting. He told her everything. The first trial versions he and Ronan had created in his bedroom, the software glitches, the meetings with a media tycoon who had flown them to Texas in his private jet and sworn at them when they refused his buyout offer. He told her of the day they'd gone public, when he sat on the edge of his bath watching the share price go up and up on his phone, and began to shake as he grasped quite how much his whole life was about to change. "You're that wealthy?" "I do okay." "Define okay." He was aware that he was this close to sounding like a dick. "Well, I was doing better until I got divorced, obviously. I do okay. You know, I'm not really interested in the money." He shrugged. "I just like doing what I do. I like the company. I like having ideas and translating them into things that actually work for people." "But you sold it?" "It was getting too big, and I was told that if we did, the guys in suits could handle all the financial stuff. I was never interested in that side of things. I just own a lot of shares." He stared at her. "You have really nice hair." He had no idea why on earth he said this. She'd kissed him in the taxi. Deanna Lewis had slowly turned his face to hers with a slim, perfectly manicured hand and kissed him. Even though it was more than 12 years since they were at university, 12 years in which Ed Nichols had been briefly married to a model, actress, whatever, some little voice in his head kept saying, "Deanna Lewis is kissing me." And she wasn't just kissing him. She hitched up her skirt and slid a long, slim leg over him, apparently oblivious to the taxi driver, pressed into him and kissed his face, his neck, and slid her hands up his shirt until he couldn't speak or think, and when he came to pay outside his flat, his words came out thick and stupid, and he not only didn't wait for the change, but didn't even check what was in the wad of notes he handed the driver.
And the sex was great. Oh, God, it was good. She had porn moves, for Christ's sake. With Lara, in the last month, sex had felt like she was granting him some kind of favour, dependent on some set of rules that only she seemed to understand, whether he had paid her enough attention, or spent enough time with her, or taken her out to dinner, or understood how he'd hurt her feelings.
When Deanna Lewis looked at him naked, her eyes seemed to light up from inside with a kind of hunger. Oh, God. Deanna Lewis. She arrived again on Friday night. She had worn these crazy knickers with ribbons at the sides that you could pull undone so that they slid slowly down her thighs like a ripple of water. She rolled a joint afterward, and he didn't normally smoke, but he had felt his head spin pleasurably, had rested his fingers in her silky hair, and felt, for the first time since Lara left, like life was actually pretty good.
And then she said, "I told my parents about us." He was having trouble focusing. "Your parents? You don't mind, do you? It's just been so good. Feeling like I belong in something again, you know?"
Ed found himself staring at a point on the ceiling. "It's okay," he told himself. "Lots of people tell their parents stuff, even after 2 weeks."
"I've been so depressed, and now I just feel..."
She beamed at him.
"Happy. Like madly happy. Like I wake up and I'm thinking about you. Like everything's going to be okay."
His mouth felt oddly dry. He wasn't sure if it was the joint.
"Depressed," he said. "I'm okay now. I mean, my folks were really good. After the last episode, they took me to the doctor and got me pills. And they definitely helped. They do, apparently, lower your inhibitions. But I can't say that anyone's complained."
He handed her the joint.
"I just feel things very intensely, you know. My psychiatrist says I'm exceptionally sensitive. Some people bounce through life. I'm not one of those people. Sometimes I can read about an animal dying or a child being murdered somewhere in another country, and I will literally cry all day. Literally. I was like it at college, too. Don't you remember?"
"No." She rested her hand on his cock. Suddenly, Ed felt fairly certain it was not going to spring to life. She looked up at him. Her hair was half over her face, and she blew at it.
"It's such a bummer losing your job and your home. You have no idea what it's like to be really broke."
She gazed at him, as if weighing up how much to tell him.
"I mean, properly broke." "What? What do you mean?" "Well, like I owe my ex a load of money, but I've told him I can't pay him. I have too much on my credit card right now. And he still keeps ringing me, going on and on about it. It's very stressful. He doesn't understand how stressed I get."
"How much are you talking about?" She told him. As his jaw dropped, she said,
"And don't offer to lend it to me. I wouldn't take money from my boyfriend. Makes things too complicated. But it's a nightmare."
Ed tried not to think about the significance of her use of the word boyfriend. He glanced down at her and saw her lower lip tremble. He swallowed.
Are you okay?"
Her smile was too swift, too wide.
"I'm good. Thanks to you, I'm really fine now."
She ran a finger along his chest.
"Anyway, it's been lovely not having to think about it. It's been heaven going out for nice dinners without wondering how I can afford it."
She kissed one of his nipples. That night she slept with one leg slung over him. Ed lay wide awake, wishing he could ring Ronan. She came back the following Friday, and the Friday after that. She didn't pick up on his hints about things he had said he had to do at the weekend. Her father had given her the money for them to have a meal.
"He says it's such a relief to see me happy again."
He had a cold, he told her, as she came skipping across the road from the tube station. Probably best not to kiss him.
"I don't mind. What's yours is mine,"
she said, and had touched herself to his face for a full 30 seconds. They ate at the local pizza place. He had started to feel a vague, reflexive panic at the sight of her.
She had feelings about things all the time. The sight of a red bus made her happy. The sight of a wilted pot plant in a cafe window made her vaguely weepy. She was too much of everything. She smiled at too many people. She was sometimes so busy talking that she forgot to eat with her mouth closed. At his apartment, she peed with the bathroom door open. It sounded like a visiting horse was relieving itself. He wasn't ready for this. She was just too needy, too erratic, too everything. Ed wanted to be on his own in the apartment. He wanted the silence, the order of his normal routine. He couldn't believe he had ever been lonely. That night, he had told her he didn't want to have sex. "I'm really tired." "I'm sure I could wake you up." She had begun to burrow her way down the duvet, and he actually had to haul her upwards. There followed a tussle that might have been funny in other circumstances. Her mouth poised to plug onto his genitals, him desperately hauling her up by the armpits. "Really, Deanna, not now." "We can snuggle then? Now I know you don't just want me for my body." She pulled his arm around her and emitted a little whimper of pleasure like a small animal. Ed Nichols lay there, wide-eyed in the dark. He took a breath. "So, Deanna, next weekend I have to go away for business." "Anywhere nice?" She ran her finger speculatively along his thigh. "Geneva." "Ooh, nice. Shall I stow away in your case?"
"What?"
"I could be there waiting for you in your hotel room. When you come back from your meetings, I could soothe your troubled brow."
She reached out a finger and stroked his forehead. It was all he could do not to flinch.
"Really? That's nice. But it's not that kind of trip."
"You're so lucky. I love traveling. If I wasn't so broke, I'd be back on a plane in an instant."
"You would?"
"It's my passion. I loved being a free spirit, going where the whim takes me."
She leant over, extracted a cigarette from the packet on the bedside table, and lit it.
"Don't suggest I bet on the stock market, Ed. I haven't got enough left to gamble with."
It was out before he really knew what he was saying. "It's not a gamble."
"What isn't?"
"We've got a thing coming out. In a couple of weeks. It's going to be a game changer."
"A thing?"
"I can't really tell you too much, but we've been working on it for a while. It's going to push our stock way up. Our business guys are all over it." She was silent beside him. "I mean, I know we haven't talked a lot about work, but this is going to make a serious amount of money." She didn't sound convinced.
"You're asking me to bet my last few pounds on something I don't even know the name of?"
"You don't need to know the name of it. You just need to buy some shares in my company." He shifted onto his side.
"Look, you raise a few thousand pounds, and I guarantee you'll have enough to pay off your ex-boyfriend within 2 weeks. And then you'll be free. And you can do whatever you want. Go wherever you like."
There was a long silence.
"Is this how you make money, Ed Nichols? You take women to bed and then get them to buy thousands of pounds worth of your shares?"
"No, it's..."
She turned over and he saw she was joking. She traced the side of his face.
"You're so sweet to me. And it's a lovely thought. But I don't have thousands of pounds lying around right now."
The words came out of his mouth even before he knew what he was saying.
"I'll lend it to you. If it makes you money, you pay me back. If it doesn't, then it's my own fault for giving you dad advice."
She started laughing and stopped when she realized he wasn't joking.
"You do that for me?"
Ed shrugged.
"Honestly, 5 grand doesn't really make a big difference to me right now.
And I'd pay 10 times that if it meant you would leave."
Her eyes widened.
"Whoa, that is the sweetest thing anyone's ever done for me."
"Oh, I doubt that."
Before she left the next morning, he wrote her a check. She'd been tying her hair up in a clip, making faces at herself in his hall mirror. She smelt vaguely of apples.
"Leave it blank," she said, when she realized what he was doing. "I'll get my brother to do it for me. He's good at all this stocks and shares stuff. What am I buying again?"
"Seriously?"
I can't help it. I can't think straight when I'm near you.